The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Deborah Love for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from a variety of academic sources. The first article is meant for those of us who might have heard the expression, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. It's from Popular Science. The writer is Lauren Leffer. And the title is, Even Old Brains Can Make New Neurons. She writes, your body is constantly generating new cells. In your digestive tract, the colon's lining turns over every 5 to 7 days. Your blood cells replace themselves every few weeks. Skin cells, about once a month. But certain organs are a big exception. Contrary to popular belief, we are not biological Theseus's ships, reconstructing ourselves entirely from fresh building blocks every 7 years. Most of your neurons, the cells that fast-track information across the brain, spine, and sensory organs, have the same lifespan as you do. Until the 20th century, the prevailing view in neuroscience was that past childhood, humans stopped making neurons brain-wide. What we have in adolescence is what we get, and all we can do is lose cells or reorganize them. However, the latest research adds to a mounting body of evidence finding that the timeline of neuron generation isn't so clear-cut. In at least two parts of the brain, a subset of neuroscientists believe that neurons may continue to form throughout life, the hippocampus and the ventral striatum. In the hippocampus, a critical brain region for learning and memory, new cells emerge in some people into a late adulthood, according to a study published July 3rd in the journal Science. The findings tip the scales in a still active debate over how our brains continue to develop throughout life. A better understanding of adult neurogenesis, the formation of new neurons, and a firm answer to it and where it occurs could help improve treatments for neurologic diseases as well as normal aging. So, are human brains uniquely static? Past research in rodents, pigs, and monkeys has shown that neurogenesis does happen in these mammals throughout life. Birds do it too. Yet, based on noted structural and developmental differences in the human brain, some scientists argue that our species is unique and lacks the lifelong neurogenesis that might interrupt complex, streamlined brain function. New neurons might sound great, but too much activity and connectivity can cause chaos. And it's difficult to get a clear answer. It's a major technical challenge to pin down new brain cells in humans because you can't readily see through living skulls at the cellular level. Researchers largely have to rely on scarce brain tissue collected via surgery on those with medical conditions like epilepsy, or tissue donated by the deceased. With this new study, I think they use some really strong tools. Mercedes Paredes, a neurologist and developmental neuroscientist at the University of California, San Francisco, tells Popular Science. Paredes was not involved in the research, but has previously found contrasting results in her own lab. The new work, she says, is a good starting point for applying novel methods to the brain and deciphering what types of cells are truly present. Other studies of potential adult neurogenesis have looked at protein and immune signatures in brain tissues to determine if, where, and how often new neurons are being formed. They've come to conflicting conclusions, Some, like Paredes in 2018, failing to identify the cells that other researchers report seeing. There have also been a few studies that rely on carbon dating to ascertain the age of neurons, which you find in young cells in adults. However, none of these methods have so far reliably pinpointed the stem cells or progenitors capable of yielding fresh neurons, leaving room for doubt. The new study seems to address this previously unresolved point. It's the quote-unquote missing link of neurogenesis, Jonas Friesen, senior study author and a developmental biologist and stem cell researcher at Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, tells Popular Science. To find that missing link, Friesen and his co-authors surveyed the scientific literature to compile a list of genes that are likely active in hippocampal neurogenesis. Then they confirmed those gene markers, largely from animal studies, by comparing them to RNA sequences found in brain samples from 6 deceased child and infant donors. Next, the team sequenced RNA from mitochondria in the brain tissue from 19 people between the ages of 13 and 78. They used 3 different machine learning algorithms to assess those sequences and identify likely intermediate forming neurocells. The scientists validated their machine learning outputs by applying the same tools to data sets from mice and adult human cortex cells and reported a false positive rate of just 0.37%. From all of their analyses, they identified 354 cells out of hundreds of thousands across their 19 samples that appeared to be precursors to new neurons, including dozens of stem cells and neuroblasts from adults. The cells weren't distributed uniformly, only showing up in half the adolescent samples and 5 of the 14 adult samples. However, whether or not the cells were present didn't seem to wholly correlate with age or documented disease. One of the adults with the highest number of neurogenesis-related cells present was a 58-year-old with no known pathology, per the study. We nailed down active neurogenesis in the adult human brain, Marta Paterlini, a neuroscientist at Karolinska Institute, told Popular Science. She co-led the new work over 8 years alongside her colleague Inua Dumitru, who focused on the machine learning side. "We are confident in our data," Paterlini says. "We would like to put an end to the controversy." Still, not everyone in the field agrees that the cells identified in this study were indisputably emerging adult neurons. "When I first heard about this study, I was excited. It's the sort of approach you want to use to ID rare subtypes," Sean Sorrells, a neuroscientist at the University of Pittsburgh, who co-authored the 2018 study with Paredes, tells Popular Science. But after a closer look, he was disappointed by how few cells they found, and in his view, there's an alternate potential explanation. "The most likely conclusion is that the cells they are looking for are rare or non-existent in most people. The other possibility is that the cells they claim are adult neural stem cells are associated with the disease process in these individuals or some other cell type altogether. The human brain is full of cells that do divide and replicate throughout life called glial cells. These are the supportive and connective cells that enable neurons to do the job of conveying nerve signals. Glial cells are a neuron's pit crew. It's possible that in their efforts to identify neurons in progress, the study authors may have inadvertently included some glial cells in their analysis," Sorrells suggests. Both Sorrells and Paredes believe more research is needed to confirm the new study's conclusions. "Direct morphological comparisons between human and animal cells could boost the findings," says Paredes. Sorrells suggests we'll need more advanced brain imaging techniques to really resolve the issue. following the same cells over time to see how they develop. That would be the best evidence for neurogenesis, he said, though notes that that's currently not possible to do. And so the science presses on. If, as the new research indicates, some healthy humans do continue to make neurons inside their hippocampuses for life, it could have major implications for psychiatric and neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, where animal studies indicate a dearth of new cells play a role. It could also aid in our ability to understand and maximize healthy aging and neuroplasticity, Friesen says. Perhaps down the line, adult neural cells could be used to help people recover after brain trauma, Paterlini suggests. The lab is working on regenerative medicine, so we will keep going on this. And maybe all their effort will manage to change minds about how much human minds can change. This next article is from The Scientist, and it's entitled Respiratory Viruses Wake Up Dormant Cancer Cells. Cancer remission, in which tumor cells enter a dormant state and a patient's symptoms subside, can persist for years or decades. Both the cancer cells themselves and the tumor microenvironment maintain this period of inactivity. While inflammation has been shown to disrupt this microenvironment, leading to metastasis, the mechanisms of this process remain unclear. Seeing a trend in increased cancer deaths in the first 2 years of the COVID-19 pandemic, cancer biologist Julio Aguirre Guiso at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine suspected that viral infections could be activating dormant cancer cells. In partnership with researchers at the University of Colorado and Utrecht University, the teams showed that inflammation from viral infections activated dormant cancer cells and increased metastasis. The findings, published in Nature, provide important insights into cancer remission for clinicians. Dormant cancer cells are like the embers left in an abandoned campfire, and respiratory viruses are like a strong wind that reignites the flames, James D. Gregory, a study co-author and cancer geneticist at the University of Colorado, said in a press release about the findings. Using two models of breast cancer with dormant cells, the researchers infected mice with either influenza A or mouse-adapted SARS-CoV-2. They saw that the number of metastatic cells increased between 3 and 15 days after infection and remained high over 9 months. This awakening coincided with changes to cell surface markers and gene expression, with previously dormant cells expressing epithelial markers and genes related to angiogenesis and cross-linking collagen. These are characteristics of active cancer cells. To mechanistically explore how the infection response activated dormant cancer cells, the researchers focused on the inflammatory cytokine interleukin 6, known as IL-6, which is expressed during viral infection. In contrast to wild-type mice, the researchers saw decreased cancer cell activation and metastasis in mice deficient for IL-6. Since IL-6 levels fall after the initial phase of the infection, the team studied other immune factors that could maintain the cancer cells' activation. They showed that depleting CD4 plus T cells decreased the number of activated dormant cells later after infection and increased the amount of cytotoxic CD8 plus T cells in the lungs. Suspecting that CD4 plus T cells could be restricting these cytotoxic cells from entering the tissue, the researchers found that the awakened cancer cells reprogrammed incoming CD4 T cells toward anti-tumor activity, including restricting CD8 T cells. Finally, the researchers studied the correlation between cancer deaths and COVID-19 infections using two different data sets. In both cases, they saw an associated risk of deaths in months following a documented infection with COVID-19. Our findings indicate that individuals with a history of cancer may benefit from taking precautions against respiratory viruses, such as vaccination when available, and discussing any concerns with their healthcare providers, Aguirre-Guiso said in the press release. Let me repeat that. Our findings indicate that individuals with a history of cancer may benefit from taking precautions against respiratory viruses. This next article from Time is about a condition that is increasingly prevalent in our society today, and that's anxiety. It's entitled, "The Worst Things to Say to Someone with Anxiety," and "What to Say Instead." When you're trying to comfort someone trapped in an avalanche of anxious thoughts, it's best to prioritize presence over advice, says Jamie Fletcher, director of therapy at Headspace, and connection over correction. That's presence over advice and connection over correction. Too often, people try to rush their friend into feeling better, dismiss or minimize their concerns, or offer unsolicited advice, all of which can exacerbate the person's already heightened emotions. It's better to focus on being calm, compassionate, and not judgmental, and brainstorming ways to support your anxious friend. We talked with experts to share the most common things you can say to someone with anxiety, plus what actually helps them. So the first worst thing is just calm down. If you want to stay on an anxious person's good side, don't tell them to calm down. It's infuriating in part because it minimizes their experience and implies they have control over something that's largely involuntary. I've never met an anxious person who hasn't tried every trick in their toolbox to decrease their symptoms of anxiety, says Leah Riddell, a licensed clinical mental health counselor who has anxiety. No one wants to have a racing heartbeat or be sweating everywhere and shaking with an upset stomach and racing thoughts. Instead, say, "I can see you're scared right now. Can I sit with you?" Focus on how you can show your friend empathy to connect on a deeper level, she advises. If you're not in a place where you can easily sit down, offer a change of scenery. "Hey, want to go somewhere quiet and walk for a second?" It might be the opportunity to decompress that they need. The next worst thing to say? There's nothing to be anxious about. Anxiety doesn't respond to logic. Yes, it's statistically unlikely that the plane will crash or that the world is going to blow up tomorrow. But when you're trapped in a spiral of worst-case scenarios, those facts mean very little. Avoid telling your friend that whatever they're worried about isn't a big deal or worth stressing over, says Ariel Setnar, a therapist in Boulder. To them, it is, and that's what counts. If you downplay someone's concerns, it makes them feel like they're doing something wrong or they're having a bad reaction, which can exacerbate their already on-edge emotions. Instead, say, "That sounds really hard. Want to tell me what's going through your mind?" We're better off lending an ear. When people externalize their thoughts, they're often able to gain some space from their worries, Setner says, which could help them start to put things in perspective. Offering that space shows, "Hey, I have compassion and I'm not judging you," she says. You can even add, "I'm here to listen, and if you want advice, I'm happy to give that to you." So, the next worst thing to say? Are you seriously worried again? The problem with pointing out that someone is anxious yet again, thank you, Captain Obvious, is that it communicates contempt, says Rosalind Perez, a therapist in Ponte Vedra, Florida. It can come across as belittling the other person or stoking shame and a sense of unworthiness. Instead, say, I've noticed you seem kind of tense today. Everything okay? Let's sit together and think through what's been helpful in the past. While judgment shuts down connection, curiosity opens the door to support, she adds. Your friend doesn't even need to explicitly tell you they're anxious for you to gently ask them about it, if you know them well. You'll be able to perceive that something is off. You're letting them know that you're paying attention and that you're coming from a place of genuine concern, Perez says. You're creating a safe haven where they can open up, be themselves, and share their worries. The next worst thing to say? Everything is going to be fine. Your anxious friend might be worrying about something that has no chance of coming to fruition, or their concerns could be spot on. It's impossible to know for sure, so avoid offering false reassurances, Perez says. I've had many clients worry about things that, in reality, could happen, she says. The approach is never to say, oh no, that's not going to happen. Instead say, let's walk through what's on your mind. What's the worst case, best case, and most likely scenario? What works better, Perez says, is talking through potential outcomes and making a plan to handle each one. That can give them perspective and allow them to feel more prepared. Another worst thing to say? You're overreacting. This is one of the most dismissive things you can say to an anxious person because it often deepens self-doubt, which goes hand in hand with anxiety. When people are anxious, they're trying to scramble for ways to settle down, Settner says. By telling them that they're doing too much, they'll feel like a burden, which will make them feel even more anxious. They already feel like a burden to themselves, and now they're a burden to you. What to say instead? Your reaction makes sense given what you've been through. Focus on reassuring them that the way they're feeling makes sense. Doing so affirms their emotional experience, Settner says, while reinforcing that they're not broken for feeling that way. Another no-no, stop thinking that way. When someone is feeling anxiety, they're often truly not able to let go of it easily, Fleischer says. Telling them to just stop it minimizes their very real physical and emotional symptoms. Instead, say, let's sit down and take 3 deep breaths together. It's more helpful to invite your friend to join you in a simple breathing activity. That small act might be enough to reset their nervous system, Fleischer says, and pluck them out of those all-consuming feelings of panic. Another phrase to avoid, at least, it might sound comforting on the surface, but telling your friend that at least it's not worse, didn't they hear what the neighbor is going through, will likely backfire. It shifts the focus away from the person's pain and sends the message that their experience isn't serious enough to deserve attention, Fleischer says. Instead say, that sounds really hard. I'm so sorry you're going through this. A better approach, let your friend know you care about and feel for them. No fancy words necessary. Empathy doesn't require silver lining, she says. True support often means simply acknowledging pain without trying to dilute it. And the last thing they say is the worst thing to say. You just need to be more positive. Toxic positivity isn't the antidote to anxiety, Fleischer stresses. Banishing anxious thoughts isn't a matter of willpower. It's a complex interaction of biology, environment, and experience, she says. Instead, say, you're not alone. I'm here with you. Tell your friend you know they're doing the best they can, and it's okay to feel anxious. Doing so acknowledges their efforts and normalizes their emotions, which reduces the shame that so often accompanies anxiety. Then, remind them that you're not going anywhere. These are the most healing words you can offer, Fleischer says. When you care about is experience anxiety, your job isn't to fix it, it's to show up for them. Okay, we have time for one more brief article. This is from the second opinion Q&A section of the Mayo Health Letter. This writer says, question, over the years, I have had plantar fasciitis off and on. Normally, I do some physical therapy and the pain goes away. But now it's only getting worse, and my doctor suggested using shockwaves. What should I know about it? The answer? Although it may sound a bit scary, shockwave therapy is a common and often effective treatment for some foot and ankle conditions, including plantar fasciitis. Extracorporeal, meaning outside the body, shockwave treatment was originally used to treat kidney stones. However, since the early 1990s, it's been used to treat certain orthopedic conditions as well. There are two different types of shockwave devices, radial and focused. A radial device works by generating pressure waves when a projectile in the handpiece contacts the skin, transmitting energy into the targeted tissue. Focused shockwave treatment involves the application of sound waves transmitted in a narrow or focused pattern, similar to how loudspeakers work. These treatments are used separately or combined, depending on the condition being treated. The treatment works by delivering sound or pressure waves into the damaged tissues to stimulate the healing process. The sound waves may reduce pain and inflammation, break up scar tissue and adhesions, promote bone healing, and improve blood flow to damaged tissue. Additionally, shockwave treatment can relax muscles. Shockwave therapy is an outpatient procedure usually done in a series of 3 to 6 treatments, spaced 3 to 7 days apart. The treatment has minimal risks, though it can cause pain, slight bruising, or mild swelling at the treatment site. While receiving the treatment, you likely will need to discontinue taking anti-inflammatory medications. The full effects of shockwave therapy can be seen up to 10 or 15 weeks after the final treatment. Most people with plantar fasciitis improve with basic care steps, such as gentle stretches, proper footwear, and short-term use of anti-inflammatory medicines or physical therapy. However, healing can be slow and frustrating, requiring patience to succeed. If you aren't finding relief, you might benefit from newer, non-surgical therapy options, such as shockwave therapy. Well, that's all we have time for today. We've covered a wide range of very complex research to some simple practical tools. Next week, I'll be reading exclusively from the Mayo Health newsletter, and we'll be looking at things, some pretty serious things, like Crohn's and spinal stenosis. So until then, thanks for listening. We'll look forward to seeing you next week. Again, this is Deb Love reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. This program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and Health Issues is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5100.